All right, good morning. Today is September 27th, and we are here for the Land Use and Sustainability Committee meeting, joined by my colleagues, Vice Chair of this committee, Laura Dominguez, and Commissioner David Richardson, as we come down to the home stretch of our final couple of land use meetings. Okay, Tom, some housekeeping items. You want to let us know what's being deferred?
Sure. Item number two, which is pertaining to landscape requirements in Chapter 126, has been deferred by the item sponsor to January of 2024. Item number three, regarding development regulation incentives for the retention and rehabilitation of historic buildings, has been deferred by the item sponsor to October 25th. Item number six, regarding proposed amendments to Chapter 46 of the Code on heritage tree designation, has been deferred by the item sponsor to January 2024. On item number five, pertaining to the Baywalk, Commissioner Laura Dominguez is now a co-sponsor of that item.
Wonderful.
And then lastly, on item number seven, we do have representatives from FP&L when we get to that item.
Okay, great. Nick, do we have anybody joining us via Zoom?
I don't see any commissioners yet, but if we do, I'll let you know.
Okay, great. Then why don't we do item number five, because that's just an update, and maybe that can go quickly.
Okay. I think Dave Martinez is here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and Commissioner. At the June 20th land use meeting, we were asked to return and specifically address a couple of elements of the Baywalks. One of them was the status of the already existing Southgate Towers Baywalk section, and also an update on the Bay Garden Manor and Bayview Terrace condominium sections. So regarding the Southgate Towers, we have been in conversations with their newer proprietorship entity called Air Communities. They have basically reviewed all the history on that particular project. They have asked a lot of questions, and ultimately the individual that I'm working with has said that they have moved this topic up higher up in their leadership. And I believe, I know there's been some other conversations on that. They asked about the previous arrangements that they thought existed in the past regarding some reimbursements for some of the work they had done on the property as part of their Baywalk construction. But they have not come back to us and given us any idea whether they're contemplating the opening or not. They're basically on standby. I reached out to them earlier this week, and I haven't received any response yet as to where they are with this.
Thank you, David. And I know that you and I had met on this last week, and I got more details as well. I think one of the things that were concerning Southgate was security. And on my end, I'll check with the park rangers and see how that works and if it's something that would help. So you and I can circle back offline on that. But thank you for the update. Really appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, I'm happy to see you co-sponsor this. I know that with you and Commissioner Fernandez co-sponsoring this, it's going to be in good hands. You know, we all urgently want to see the Baywalk completed. You know, we got a lot of things in motion, but it won't be done until every single piece is done. David, slightly off topic, do you have an update on the pedestrian bridge by any chance? Would you happen to know?
Certainly. The pedestrian bridge, the design team under the developer, they've formally submitted their application to the Department of Transportation. The initial application is usually a 90% developed set of documents, which also includes the city's independent peer review, which is required by the state. So that is now in FDOT's court. They have also submitted to the city's building department for their review and feedback. As a matter of fact, we have a meeting scheduled with them, including Mr. Carpenter, in a couple of weeks, next week or the week after, in the next couple of weeks, to really get down to the nitty-gritty, specifically talking about factors like what does the means of traffic plan going to look like for something like that? Because obviously we don't want to cripple the city for any extended amount of time. As you know, as you can imagine, we have to at some point shut down MacArthur Causeway. You can't build a bridge without doing that. So how long does it take? Where do you detour? And what does that look like? They are heavily trying to hit commencement of construction this calendar year. Of course, a lot of it will depend on how the permitting goes through the Department of Transportation and all of that. So that's kind of where we are with that.
And if I could just add one thing, we also are in communication with their team about the long-term agreement that will be required from FDOT about the pedestrian bridge and the maintenance thereof. So we may be bringing back as early as the October commission meeting the form agreement with FDOT for the maintenance of that bridge, which would ultimately pave the way to FDOT issuing the permit.
Awesome. Yeah. Again, as a I'll be leaving soon. Just want to make sure that that pedestrian bridge doesn't get stalled in any way, because it'd be a travesty to finish the Baywalk and then that's the last remaining piece. I'd like to see the pedestrian bridge finished before the missing pieces of the Baywalk, which I think is more likely than not.
Yeah, so Eric, to your point, is the agreement with FDOT going to be for the city to maintain, or what are the general terms?
Yeah, the pedestrian bridge will be a city asset. It will be part of our Baywalk, and it will be our responsibility to maintain within the FDOT right-of-way.
Thanks.
Exciting. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if you like, I can complete. It's a very brief update on the other two. Unfortunately, we've ran into some complications with working with the previous consultant that we were seeking a new proposal. We had to abandon utilizing that particular firm. So unfortunately, we had to restart with a new firm. We have proposals in to get that one going. And just this one, what we're doing with Bay Garden Manor and Bayview is the same thing we're doing with the South Bay Club. We've broken it up into some phases because it's a lot to do, especially with the permitting as well as the negotiations with the upland property owners. So first, phase one that we completed was strictly analyzing the area, doing some surveys and studies, having pre-meetings with the regulatory agencies, having meetings with the property owners that would have to grant us easements and permission to build the facility, as well as prepare some renderings that they could visualize what these things would look like. So we kind of got to a good place there, that task finished. So now we're talking about the next phase. The next phase is preparing a basis of design report for all the three locations, which includes the actual beginning of permitting. And then following that, because of the size of the projects, from a financial perspective, we would have to do a formal RFQ to solicit an actual designer that would take it through all the way. So that's kind of the path for both the three of these.
Is there anything you need, or Eric, anything you guys need from us as you have to switch out consultants or possibly go to RFQ and stuff like, and I know I'm leaving, but don't hesitate to ask us. It's a priority for all of us to get this Baywalk done. So if something comes up where you need additional money or authorization or direction, just approach us. You know, Laura and Alex are going to be shepherding this. Either one of them or, you know, all of us make this a priority. This is essential that we get this thing done.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. And I know that Commissioner Richardson was very specific asking about the money situation. I think we're still good right now. This next task, there's sufficient funds to get us through that. Once we start thinking about putting out an RFQ for design and getting closer into when construction could be in another year or two, then at that time, certainly, it would be the appropriate time to bring it through the capital budget in a proper planning fashion and put it through the cycle.
So are you using existing work order for your consultant now? So that you don't
right. What occurred was, Commissioner, we had one consultant that was doing task one for both for all three sections, South Bay and the other two, the Bay Garden and Bayview Terrace. As part of the state law, the CCNA, Consultants Competitive Negotiation Act, the work they were doing fell under what they qualify as a study. a study has a maximum expenditure of $500,000. So what was happened with the initial task, we were already, and I forget the amount, close to $200,000 with everything they had done. So it only left us wiggle room for $300,000 to continue working on the other three. So what it would cause, I would run out of authority legally at some point to complete that study. So what we did was we broke it up. We have a different one consultant is going to handle the north two and a separate consultant the other two as the continuation of the phase two, which is still considered the study phase.
But you have the money for that, right?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yes, we do.
All right.
Do you want to get an update in the next couple months? When would you like your next update for the Baywalk item?
Commissioner Dominguez, do you want a 90
yeah,
days or
continue for next meeting?
So
in the meantime, I'll do some homework on park ranger security and some of the buildings that were resisting, and we'll
all right.
Talk
so
in October.
We'll show this continued to October 25th.
Okay.
Okay. Great. Super.
Thank you.
Thanks. Commissioner Dominguez, do you want to hear your item number 8? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the item here was to talk about incentives for residential developments. There's been some issues throughout the city where buildings are being converted to transient uses, hotels, and things of that nature, and look for ways where we can have them stay as long-term residential incentives and things of that nature.
Okay. Does anybody, Tom, you?
We had, as part of the memo for this item, we had come up with some initial concepts that we've used in the past to incentivize residential uses or converting to residential uses. As the commission is aware, recently over the last couple of years, there have been FAR questions that have gone to the voters and actually been approved regarding specific FAR incentives in the RPS 1 and RPS 2 districts south of 5th to incentivize the conversion of existing apartment hotels to residential apartment, also in the RPS 4 oceanfront district to convert hotels to residential apartments. So increasing maximum allowable FAR can oftentimes be one of the chief incentives. Other incentives could include increasing maximum allowable building height, modifications to minimum parking requirements, and expanding allowable accessory uses in medium intensity residential districts. So these obviously would need to be further developed and would be specific to certain areas, but generally speaking, those are the types of incentives that have been used previously.
Thank you, Tom. And I would be concerned with not having something cookie cutter, because as you mentioned, the different neighborhoods have different zoning and height, and I wouldn't want to have something come out of scale for the neighborhood, because you know we're trying to do good for housing in the city. So thank you.
Comments?
Let me ask. Mm-hmm. Thanks. So I'm certainly not opposed to this concept, but I refresh my memory. I think some months back after what happened south of 5th, we asked you all to look at whether or not there were other areas where there was a potential risk that this could happen and whether or not we should sort of do something in those areas similar to what we did south of 5th. And I think you all said that we were good, but
As it pertains to apartment hotels, we did do a deep dive into all other zoning districts, and we concluded that the RPS 1 and 2 areas were the only sort of anomalies that allowed apartment hotels in a district that didn't otherwise allow transient uses. And so we were able to determine that there are no other districts that are like that. I think this particular item wants to go a little bit further and look at areas where transient uses are permitted, but incentivizing residential construction so that people would either choose to do residential construction in those districts or potentially convert existing transient uses to residential.
Okay, thanks.
So there's more to discuss here. Yep.
So, I mean, my two cents on this is it's a good idea, right? I think things that we can do to change transient uses to, you know, more permanent, particularly residential uses, particularly, you know, workforce housing, we should pursue. You know, I've got an item here, number one, that we'll discuss in a little bit that could tie into this as well. To some extent, Commissioner Fernandez's item four, which is a process question around how do you create FAR procedures. They all tie in together. And then, you know, I think in the coming months, as Tallahassee, the legislature gets back together, this FAR question is going to be, you know, I think front and center for a lot of us. You know, there are rumblings, at least one of us on the commission is pushing for a 6/7 or 7/7 vote of the commission for FAR increases. One is, I think you're basically inviting Tallahassee to just completely preempt us if we go that route. But I also think it's extremely bad policy because there are so many times where we want to try to, you know, incentivize a particular development to go in a certain way and to take away our tools in doing that, basically, you know, limits our ability to influence policy. This is a perfect example where, you know, we would want to, you know, maybe try to change transient uses that's not conforming with a neighborhood, and you might be able to dangle FAR, but if we have such a high threshold, nothing can get done. And we've seen voters time and again approve FAR in cases where it makes a lot of sense. Tallahassee has changed that and put it back on elected officials. The threshold's 5/7, which is already a very high standard. I would encourage us not to entertain something that would basically just take away our tools to do good policy and invite Tallahassee to just take away all authority on this item. So I don't know what you want to do with this. I think it's a very good idea. You know, I don't know what direction you want to move forward with.
If it's okay, let's bring it back for next month. And in the meantime, I'll work with Tom on more specifics so that we have something more concrete.
Yeah. What I also see very often, I'll say this when this item comes up with the full commission, so many times where, you know, there are close votes, even a 4-3 vote, or, you know, when you have a higher threshold, like 5/7 or 6/7 in some cases, what happens is you'll have a commissioner, and I remember one in particular who's no longer serving with us but is running for office, would literally be a terrorist. At the last minute, after things have been through multiple hearings at land use, neighborhood associations, planning board, at the 11th hour when all the votes were, you know, tallied up, but they just needed that one more vote, they'd be the lone holdout and just terrorize the project to get things that frankly benefit them and not necessarily the community, get the person, you know, additional accolades for, you know, last minute holdout, extorting, and I use that word deliberately, you know, extra things from a developer that already has gone through, you know, months long or years long processes with the community and neighborhood associations and our legal counsel, economic development team, everything. And then at the last minute, this is what happens. And sometimes, you know, it turns into political donations to a candidate that they're supporting or other charitable or other things that they hold dear. And so when you put that much power in the hands of a lone person, by having such a high threshold of 6/7 or 7/7, what you're inviting is extortion. And I really, really emphatically encourage us not to go that route.
Thank you.
Let me add a comment since you brought up the 6/7. I, too, think it would be a mistake because we enjoy 5/7 right now, and if the state preempts, they would probably just do a simple majority. So then we go back to 4/7. And so I think a 6/7 would just invite them to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so we'll show this as continued to the next meeting, October 25th.
Yep. Why don't we tackle item number seven, because we have some folks here from outside. This is to discuss FPNL's Storm Secure Underground program and opportunities to identify the City of Miami Beach neighborhoods that may be eligible for undergrounding power lines through the program at no cost or expense to city residents or businesses. This is my item, and Commissioner Miner's also co-sponsoring this, and I'm glad I have a co-sponsor because, again, I'm leaving in a month. And, you know, I don't know why necessarily there's such resistance from FPL on something like this. I think if anyone's paying attention to the horrific tragedy and scandal that's happening in Hawaii, largely caused by down power lines that, you know, caused a fire that ultimately raged out of control and has cost thousands of lives, even though for whatever reason it's being covered up, and officially it's only like 100. But anyway, when I saw that, I said, okay, this is even more reason to accelerate the undergrounding of power lines that can cause fire. We're in a hurricane zone, and you just look at the tragedy in Hawaii, and it highlights the need to do everything we can to make our city more resilient and more insulated from, you know, the effects of natural disasters that can do things like cause power lines to go down and start fires. Joe?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Dominguez, Vice Mayor Richardson, Joe Gomez, Public Works Director. If you recall, at our June 20th land use meeting, you asked us to do a couple of things after FPL provided the initial presentation, was to receive additional information from FPL and also to look at the possibility of bringing in a consultant similar to the City of Coral Gables using a consultant for their SSUP. I'm pleased to report to you that as of August, we've engaged the services of Stantec, the same consultants working with the City of Coral Gables. Ramon Costella, Vice President with Stantec, is here today. He is going to be running point with me on the meetings with FPL as we progress through the progress. We also have our representatives from FPL here today to give an update on the SSUP program. They have additional information that I think is going to be very beneficial to the committee. So with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Chris Ferreira from FPL. Chris.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to set the timer?
How much time do you need? I'll be generous. We're good on time.
5 minutes?
5 minutes? Okay.
Yeah. So thank you, Joe, and good morning, everyone. My name is Christopher Ferreira, and I am an External Affairs Area Manager for Florida Power Light Company. At FPL, we're constantly working to deliver America's best energy value for our customers. Energy is not only reliable, but also affordable and clean. We're here today to provide a follow-up presentation on our Storm Secure Underground program. When we last presented to this committee back in June of this year, we were asked to gather additional information on the program and timing for future projects in the Miami Beach area. We have provided staff with copies of the 2022 FPL Annual Reliability Report, the 2022 FPL Storm Protection Plan, and a Miami Beach Reliability Study. In all, we have provided over 2,000 pages of information to the city. Our goal today is to provide a refresher on the program and give an outlook on future SSUP projects in the area. It's important to note that the information presented at the June Land Use Committee meeting was information that is based on our currently approved 2-year work cycle. The information we're presenting today is beyond that currently approved 2-year work cycle and is using reliability data that was gathered earlier this year. These project timelines are subject to change based on changes in service reliability in the future. But before we begin the presentation, I did want to highlight a few key statistics to keep in mind during the presentation. Currently, about 63% of FPL customers within the City of Miami Beach receive their power via underground service. And I think that's important to keep in mind and understand that right now, today, 63% of customers receive underground service. Within the City of Miami Beach, there are 35 overhead lateral miles, and all are included in the SSUP program. Of these 35 overhead lateral miles, more than half are planned to be in design or construction within the next 10 years. At FPL, we're committed to working with the City of Miami Beach to continue delivering America's best energy value. And at this time, I'd like to introduce Amy Kemp, who is our customer outreach leader with the SSUP program, to walk us through the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be in front of you once again. Like Christopher mentioned, just we'll go through a quick overview of the program to refresh and then, of course, be open to any questions. I do think we might need more than 5 minutes, so I'll try to speed through it. Is it showing on the screen? All right, perfect. So as Christopher mentioned, the SSUP is a significant endeavor for us to improve the reliability of our customers and of these lines across the entire state. I do want to take a step back and just recognize that SSUP is actually part of the larger hardening journey and initiatives that FPL has been taking since the historical 405 hurricane season. So when we think of reliability, when we think of the impact and susceptibility that Florida has as a state, you're absolutely correct. We are so exposed as a state, just being surrounded by water, by hurricanes. I mean, we've seen that with the past hurricanes that have just passed. Since 05, 06, we have implemented significant initiatives to harden our grid from the longest lines to now our smaller lines that are our customer lines or our laterals, as we mentioned. What you see on the screen are some of those initiatives that have already improved the reliability of our customers throughout the entire state. I can tell you that from when Hurricane Wilma impacted our state, the time for restoration for our customers on average across the entire state was about 5 days, significantly high. 5 days, I think, is too much to any customer. When Hurricane Irma impacted the state, that restoration time was reduced by about half. Now, that was still long, right? We recognize that, but that was due in part of the significant improvements that were incorporated based on our feeder hardening program, our vegetation, tree trimming, our pole inspection, and even our smart readers. So SSUP is the continuation of those efforts to continue bringing this improvement and this enhancement to our grid. Hurricane Irma significantly impacted our state, specifically on those lines that are closest to the customers, where, as you pointed out, Commissioner, vegetation is a significant impact to our customers. And that's what we saw was the number one cause for these outages during Hurricane Irma. So that's the reason why SSUP is focused specifically on undergrounding those lateral lines. So just from a pure perspective and understanding of the lines and what we've accomplished, we're familiar with the fact that our generation is taking place at the power plants. We have focused on hardening our transmission lines. So those larger lines that, of course, transfer our power from the power plants to the substations have been hardened. So that has been one area that we've mitigated that risk. As we've transitioned from transferring that power from the substations to the general communities, those feeder lines have been hardened because that is a significant risk as well. If you look through all of these large boulevards and areas, there's still some risk and susceptibility on vegetation impacts. That program is essentially coming to its conclusion. And now what we have left is the lateral lines. So even though it's a small part of our system, it's still where customers see it most. So that's the focus of this program. As you see on the screen, it's those neighborhood lines that are typically in the rear of properties, sometimes in the front of those properties. Now, the question's always, of course, when are you going to do this? Why, you know, how are you selecting these? Because we have over 5.6 million customers in our service territory, it's very important that we continue to underground these customers in a timely manner and doing it in the best way to be able to serve all customers that need it. With the Florida Public Service Commission, we have three criteria that help us rank these projects across the entire state based on reliability. So we've looked at the reliability criteria on those lines based on previous hurricane impacts. We've looked at vegetation impacts. We've looked at just regular day-to-day operations because these three are key drivers of what customers face from a reliability perspective. Now, on an ongoing basis, we have to review this criteria and file with the Florida Public Service Commission every 3 years. So that's why sometimes we are limited in the information that we can share just because we're having to continuously review that reliability information. Today, we will be able to give you a look ahead past that in an effort to try to share some information per your request. Now, of course, when we do underground this service, again, based on those reliability metrics, we are moving all of these lines to the front of properties to ensure that we maintain accessibility for our crews, but also we minimize any type of vegetation impacts. So those electric lines that are typically in the back of the property with that service drop connecting to the home get placed in the right-of-way. We would request permits from the local municipalities. We place those transformers, preferably in the private property, requesting easements from customers. And then we adapt a junction box to allow that home to receive underground power. Now, it's very important to highlight that with this program, because it is specifically focused only on our electric lines, we're only undergrounding our electric lines. So if there are any poles that are joint use on those poles, those could remain. We would top those poles. We are communicating with the other utilities to be able to share a look ahead of our construction plans so that they have an understanding, because we recognize to the constituents, to you all, understanding the pole ownership and what the ultimate construction plan will look like is important as well. So I'd like to turn to the look ahead that we shared, and this might be a little bit tough to see. We do have our engineering lead, Eduardo, that can speak to specifics on the maps that we'll share. But as you can see, we've listed the different feeders that service the general Miami Beach area. And we have the range of time for coming up in the underground conversion process between 2025 and 2028. That is the most information we have right now because, as I mentioned, we have to continue using that reliability criteria and anything can change, right? We had Hurricane Ian, we had Hurricane Nicole, we have Hurricane Idalia. When we continue filing with the PSC, that reliability criteria will continue to be revisited. So this is what we can share at this point. The commitment that I can give to you all on behalf of SSUP is that we can continue this conversation on an ongoing basis, annual by annual, if necessary, to make sure that as things change, we continue providing you the latest and greatest information. And then that way we can make sure we communicate on a clear path and clear lines. So two maps. Eduardo can share specifics towards the end if you'd like, but I can share the two general areas where there have been some general question. What you see highlighted are those lines that are in that chart that we shared. And then with that, I'd like to just give you a quick visual of those individuals that are here today so you understand that those individuals that are going to be working on this project are local Miami-based. This is their home. This is their territory, so it is important to them as well that we can underground that service. We are a reliability-driven program, so there's unfortunately no opportunity to advocate or change the timeline that we have because we have to serve all customers using that reliability criteria. But we do have a municipal program, as I know you're very aware.
And pardon the interruption, that reliability criteria, how is that set?
So we look at the feeder lines. So the main feeder lines that they typically think on the main boulevards, that feeder essentially branches off to service local areas, local communities. So we look at the reliability criteria of that feeder and we say, what has been the outage for that general area on average based on hurricanes, based on vegetation impacts, and based on day-to-day? And that way we can review what's the risk factor on that.
But you guys keep all that data, right? FPNL keeps track of all that data.
And we share it and we file it with the PSC when we do file that plan.
Right.
Yes, sir.
And that PSC is a governmental appointed body?
That's correct. They're our elected body.
They're appointed by?
They're not elected. They're appointed by the government.
They're appointed, yes, sir.
Yeah. I mean, this is the issue, right? And it's regulatory capture, right? FPNL is the largest, or certainly one of the largest employers, easily top three most influential corporations in Florida and in the legislature, very generous with donations, you know, and the PSC has, you know, traditionally been one of those bodies that has been captured by Florida Power and Light. So you're being regulated by, and this is not you're just in a tough spot, but you're being regulated by folks that are typically very favorable to you, either worked for FPNL or will work for FPNL and or, you know, have some kind of affiliation with FPNL. So, like, this is the frustration that cities have and consumers have, you know, to try to get recourse against a monopoly that controls the regulatory process. I just don't know what we can do about something like this, you know, other than try our best to elect elected officials with integrity and backbone who can stand up to monopolistic entities that, you know, control the legislature.
Well, so, I can't speak to the, I mean, the
you,
comments.
You don't have
I understand.
To defend the company. You're just in a, you're in a tough spot. That's just the reality of it.
So if I can just jump in, or do you want to take it?
Yeah, I'd say I hear where you're coming from. The one thing I will share is the susceptibility that we have as a state and as a utility is very real due to hurricanes. So much so that the legislation actually encourages undergrounding. So we are committed to the PSC to continue undergrounding as quickly, efficiently, and effectively as possible. So it may not be, I think, as quickly as constituents may want, but we are trying every effort to make sure that we're always giving as much as possible.
And if I can just add, you know, I mentioned that in my comments when I opened up, or the introductory comments, right? We did provide copies of those reports, which are public record, to staff. Our annual reliability report, which covers all 3,000 or 4,000 feeders throughout the whole state, the storm protection plan, all those documents were provided in an effort to provide some transparency to you all and to staff to have that information.
Yeah, can you put that slide back up where you had all the different neighborhoods? That right there.
This one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's remarkable about that is it's only going to affect 3,796 customers in a city that's 87 or 90,000 people. And I don't understand why density is not affected. So for example, I live in Flamingo Park, and I think you've got about 40% of the population in South Beach. So, and I don't know about reliability. One thing I've told Chris before, like in my neighborhood, the power goes out on a regular basis. In fact, it just went out the other day for about 15 seconds, knocked out everything. So I kind of feel like I've got the worst neighborhood in the city of Miami Beach. Maybe not, but it goes out, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times a year. But why is it that you don't focus on density? Like, you're doing a project with, you know, 75 customers affected. Why not do an area where 10,000 customers are affected, you know? And is maybe it's fiscal. Who's paying? Are the customers paying for that? Is that or does it come out of your fees that you get approved by the PSC?
Sure. So I think I heard three different things. Number yeah. one is the timeline you see on the screen, the density, and then the cost. Is that
yeah.
correct? Okay. So what you see on the screen is a look ahead that we were able to provide based on the current reliability metrics, the current information and feeders that we had to be able to give you some look ahead. Now, I will just share in terms of growth of the program. When we started as a pilot, we were actually doing what we call the lateral approach, where in your neighborhood, is your example, you could be servicing maybe 8 customers off that lateral. And so we were actually just focusing on that small portion, that lateral, to underground those small portions of the community that fit that reliability criteria. That wasn't going to be sustainable. So we actually transitioned in 2022 to doing a larger focus, a larger model on actually using the reliability criteria of the feeders. So instead of just looking at this one block of the neighborhood, now we're able to do this entire neighborhood, entire community, to be able to bring that benefit to the overarching area. Now, I can tell you that based on our current, our last filing and our last settlement with the PSC back in October of 22, customer density will be something that will be considered after 2025. Because to your point, there is an impact based on customer density, on the restoration timeframe, the time it takes for our crews to actually transition and travel to those areas. And that will be focused on those regions in the state, really South Florida, that are more susceptible to those storms, but also that face that larger impact on density, on restoration time, and travel. Now, the third piece on cost, SSGP is part of our storm protection plan. That was a legislation that was approved back in 2019. And so this allows for cost recovery from our customers. So essentially, the customers have prepaid for all of the programs that are part of our storm protection plan, which includes SSGP, which includes vegetation trimming, which includes pole inspection, which also includes feeder hardening and everything else. For the average customer in 2023, that's about a $3 charge. So it has already been prepaid, and for that reason, we have to make sure that we're using the reliability criteria to ensure that we're ranking those projects in that timely manner. Now, undergrounding is just one of the factors that plays into the overarching reliability criteria, as you can probably see from the reports that Christopher shared in regards to Miami Beach. When we underground service, that means we're reducing the vulnerability of those lines and improving their reliability. Outages don't necessarily are completely eliminated, but they're completely, you know, mitigated as it relates to vegetation. But now, instead of having to send crews to those lines that used to be overhead and now are underground and don't have an outage, we can transition those crews more quickly to those lines that are still overhead to reduce that restoration time to make sure that that impact is reduced. And as we're continuing to underground more individuals to complete feeder hardening, to continue with our continuous tree trimming service, then we're reducing that restoration time and outage time effectively.
And if I can, just add, you know, specific to Miami Beach, right? I mentioned earlier, 63% of the city customers within the city already receive power underground. If we can pull up the map, the first map, that one, most of the projects, right, and most of the laterals, and that's the key thing to think about here, right, are, I would say, located on the western side of the island, right, away from where the denser parts of development of the city are. That 63%, I guarantee you, are probably on Collins Avenue, along Washington Avenue, where there's condominium buildings. That area is already underground, right? So what you're going to see is, specifically, and let's use this as an example, right? This area along 41st Street is all single-family residential neighborhood for the most part, right? So these projects that you see on the chart that we had up earlier reference those customers, right? And so that's why you're seeing that it's maybe not, you know, 1,000 on one project or 2,000 or 3,000, but it's a few hundred on each line, right? And these are the laterals that branch off. And then the other thing to keep in mind is, and if you go to the next slide, is that there's also feeders that are running through these areas as well, right, that may be overhead. And those are not part of the SSUP program, right? And so, like, I think this is a good representation of where you may have a few laterals that branch off, but in between you have feeders that are running that will not be part of the program. And so I just want to address that as part of the question on density. That's why you're seeing the numbers that you're seeing on the slide.
Yeah, so can I let me follow up on so, and you mentioned, you know, Washington and so forth, but Flamingo Park, for example, I don't know, I'm guessing 10,000 people live there, right? So put the slide up back up there. So you've got, see, and I don't want to begrudge any of these neighborhoods from, because it all should be, but I don't know how 63% of the customers could be getting underground right now when I don't see any underground in Flamingo Park. In the bulk of South Beach, which is a huge population. In fact, it could be as much as an eighth of the entire city. So, but we can get offline and you can show me where the 63.
Pardon me, but also has the most tree canopy probably in the city, which would, you know, go into one of your factors, lend itself to being more hazardous in the event of, you know, inclement weather like a hurricane where trees are going to fall because it's so densely populated with trees.
Exactly. So, you know, these, now to the question on but you're saying density is not currently a factor in determining where you're going to underground, but it will be in 25. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, so in 2025, there is our reliability selection will remain unchanged. What the main minor differentiation that will take place is that customer density, the time it takes for restoration crews to travel, would just become an additional item to look at. But the feeders will still be selected based on that reliability criteria. But South Florida will essentially be a significant focus for the program.
So with each one of these neighborhoods that you've listed here, or maybe not neighborhood, but lines, Do you have the data that shows how many outages you have on average a year in each one of these areas?
I believe that's what Christopher shared. It's what we call our franchise reliability report that shows a summary of the total amount of outages, the total amount of flickers, the duration. I believe that's what you shared. And
we have it on the franchise or the citywide study, right, that averages out the lines. And then we also have the 2022 annual reliability report that includes every line in the system, every feeder line.
So can you get me, for all those that you have in your plan, can you get me the number of outages on average per year? That's the data you have?
I believe
I can share that report with you.
Yeah, we'll share the report.
Is it in the same format, though, so that I could see those 693, for example, on your top line item? How many outages per year do they have?
So I'll have to get back with the reliability team on that. To my understanding, the limited capabilities that we have from reporting are at the franchise level, but I'm not part of the reliability team, so we'll have to get you an answer on that.
Okay. Well, Chair, if you don't mind, let's bring this back. Sure. Whose item is this?
Mine and Miner's.
Commissioner Miner and myself.
And yourself. So if you don't mind, can we bring it back in October so that you can come and present that data?
Yep.
Mr. Chairman,
we can supply that to you without having to come back. I mean,
You can supply it to me, but I'd like you to come back so I can ask questions about it. So, and then to the cost, the question on the cost, I was unclear on your answer. So,
okay.
So, what I was asking is if you'll put up that slide, those customers. So, example, the 693, when you underground them, are they going to see additional charges on their bill, or are you just charging everybody in the state and that pool of money then goes to pay for this?
That's correct. The latter is correct.
Ah,
so
okay.
All customers in our system are paying in, for lack of better words, into the storm protection plan to essentially support the continued hardening efforts that include SSUP, that include feeder hardening and all these other projects. So those 693 customers have, through their bills, through our cost recovery clause, have already prepaid for all of these efforts. And as those efforts have concluded, those reliability benefits have essentially continued.
And myself as a customer, I'm also paying, right, mm-hmm. for all that underground to be done in those neighborhoods, but not in my neighborhood.
Correct. But in your neighborhood, perhaps we're doing pole inspections. Perhaps we're doing tree trimming. Perhaps we're hardening the line. So that cost is not just for undergrounding. The $3 I mentioned is for every single customer on our entire service territory on average.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand. But so when the palm and hibiscus was underground a few years ago as part of that project, I was told by somebody that lived there that they were paying for that, but it doesn't sound like that's accurate, or is it? Was that a special circumstance?
They went through the municipal conversion program, which is they can elect to underground feeder lines and or lateral lines, right? And they are able to move forward. And at that time, this program did not exist, right? At the time that project was happening, this program that was not around. So they elected to move forward. And I forgot, you know, what the mechanism is, but the city worked with the association, and they basically the customers there paid for that service.
So that's completely separate.
And so this is a new program.
This was started back in 2017 as a pilot, or 2018
yep.
as a pilot, and was approved as a full-fledged program in 2022.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that? I recall, but I don't know the specifics.
So, yes, the municipal program that they're referring to is one that was used on more recently on Hibiscus Island. It's currently being contemplated for West Palm. East Palm was done through the municipal program. Sunset Islands 3 and 4 were done through the municipal program. And I believe Dolito and San Marino are contemplating the municipal program. I think Rivo Alto was already done under the municipal program. So we have a number of neighborhoods that have used the municipal program. I'm also aware of a couple of instances where just a group of individuals have contacted FP&L directly and have kind of pooled their resources and gotten a small segment of the overhead utility lines underground as just a homeowners association or a group of owners. But that is, from my understanding, that is all paid for by the property owners through an agreement with the city and FPNL.
That's so, correct. And so on our end, just I think to differentiate the two, and we actually have a comparison that we can share with you so that you can have an easy apples-to-apples comparison. On our end with SSUP, we take ownership of the entire process from the design, the easement acquisition, permitting to ultimate construction and restoration. When you go through the municipal conversion program, FPL would work with the local municipalities or cities to provide that plan, provide those designs, and essentially support. But there is the entire cost and ownership of the project execution is the cost that the customers essentially would pay.
So there are there two. So there's this municipal program and the program that you've just you're the statewide program.
Yes,
where
sir.
We're paying. Are there any other programs?
Not to my knowledge, those are the only two we have.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Well, I would like to see the outages for those all those in your planning. So if you'll send that to me, and then if it's your item, I'd love to have you guys come back and present that at the next meeting.
Yeah, and then. Eric, the financing of the municipal program, as I understand it, could be wrong on this, is the financial mechanism, does it just go into their property taxes to pay for it?
So there's two different versions. There is the county version where it goes through a special taxing district where the county creates a special taxing district on their behalf, and, yes, it hits their tax bill. And then when it happens directly with the city of Miami Beach, and I'll ask David maybe to add a little bit of color to this, but my understanding is that we front the money and then they pay it back over a 10-year period, and I guess that's attached to their tax bill, but I'm not certain since we're not the taxing authority.
I can respond to that. The mechanism is the creation of a special assessment district. And in the past, property owners either have the option to pay all at once or over a 10-year term. If they pay over a 10-year term, there's an added cost for financing.
Yeah. But, so that was my recollection. And originally, I was interested in this back when I first got elected. You know, it just seems to me, and it's obvious when you hear the neighborhoods who have already done this or are contemplating, they're the wealthy neighborhoods. They get it. You know, I'm interested in, you know, our multifamily dwellings where you have more density. Maybe they don't have the political influence or necessarily the money up front, but to the extent of the city and as a policy, if we wanted to do it, you know, do we want to, you know, work with these neighborhoods and work with, you know, our partners at FPNL to say the city will pay for it and we'll, you know, get reimbursed so that we can, you know, further, you know, fortify and make our city more resilient in the event of hurricanes. And, you know, the reason I wanted to have you all in here is to see to what extent FPNL would be willing to actually work with us as opposed to, you know, come up with stories on why you can't do it or, hey, we got this great statewide program, which is never going to, you know, we'll never avail ourselves of it in my lifetime. You know, could we just work with you and say, hey, look, we'll undertake a billion-dollar fortification program here in Miami Beach. Will you work with us to underground all our lines, you know, regardless of your statewide program? We'll undertake on a formal basis a municipal program setting up special taxing districts or some such mechanism. You know, would FPNL be willing to work with the city on that kind of thing? You know, we'll pay for it. You guys do it. But then we have our city fortified and we avoid a situation like Lahaina in Hawaii has found itself.
Sure. Thanks, Commissioner Roll. I think we first responded to the request to provide an overview and address questions regarding SSUP. But if the interest is with our commission or municipal program, then we can certainly connect you with the right individuals and you can go down that path. But I do want to share, though, you know, the term never. I would respectfully disagree. You know, we did try to give you that look ahead for the next 8 years. And our commitment to you is that we continue that type of collaboration because it is equally important to us. So we'll be back in October whenever Christopher and the team provide that information. And then we can address any questions that you may have.
I mean, we're a small island. We're barely a mile wide and 7 miles long. So, I mean, if we actually said, look, we want to, over the next 10 years, bury 60% of our lines, 70% of our lines, what would it cost? And together with some of our resiliency programs, do it simultaneously, you know, we could actually get something done rather than relying on this sort of, you know, lottery system that constantly is rotating. you know, do we formally want to undertake a vision to, you know, underground the majority of our lines, especially in, you know, densely populated areas of our city?
But, well, you know, and if you'll allow me, I mean, they're saying 63's already been done, so it's only 37% of the people. That's what you're saying. When you come back next month, I'd like you to bring and show us where the 63% is. Like, that'd be great to know, maybe a map or something, so we know where the 37% is at as well. So you must know what neighborhoods you've got 63% of the all. Because I think what, if I heard you right, 63% of all your customers in the city of Miami Beach have underground right now.
Correct.
That's correct.
So that only leaves 37%. So I'd like to see where the 63 is and where the 37 is.
Okay. So let me just, I was also going to ask a question to clarify on what you're requesting in terms of information, right? Because you asked us to come back next month and provide reliability data on...
On all those in your plan, that chart that you have.
On that slide.
On, you've got a slide, so I would like to see all the reliability, your statistics on all those that are in your plan.
Okay.
Okay, and then also give us a hot map on where the 63 is, and then we'll know where the 37's at, because it'll be anything that's not in your 63.
Okay, that I'll have to see if we can provide, but we'll go back and talk to the team.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious where you're getting that number and where, I don't know how many customers you have. You probably know that if it's, I don't know, I know what our population is roughly, but there are multiple people that live in homes, so I don't know how many different billing addresses you have in the city, but you'll know that.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in. Did you say we had a caller? Yes, we
have one caller, okay. Wayne Roberts.
All right. Good morning, Wayne. Are you calling about this item?
I am, Ricky. I just want to state that I lost two very dear friends in a fire in Lahaina, and one is missing 3 days from the birth of their first grandson. And the father is the one who's missing. And it's 97 dead, 31 is missing. So we're not losing thousands, but it's a horrible event.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear for your loss, Wayne. I'd love to talk to you offline. I mean, what's shocking is, yeah, the 97, you know, the tally that I'm hearing is, you know, low 100. But yet you have 2,000 missing. How are 2,000 people missing two months after?
There's only 31 missing. But
okay, well, but it wouldn't be the first time you and I disagree, but that fact is completely wrong. But it doesn't matter. That's not what we're talking about today.
I'm talking to the head of FEMA about it, so I kind of got the full
FEMA,
full,
the government agency that's covering up for this, right?
Come on, there's enough mistrust in government.
Right,
to
it's
start
not like the first
crap.
Time FEMA mistrust.
All right.
Let's look at Katrina.
There's a reason for the mistrust, but this isn't one of them. But and for Citizen United, you know, don't blame FPL for the lack of democracy after Citizen United. They're just taking advantage of the situation that they're given. I mean, that's the way reality is in America today. But I am a firm believer that the poor and the middle class are getting the short end of the stick with you, Ricky. The you know, affluent single families that were Collins Avenue or high luxury properties are getting underground electricity. And the overhead is largely in the lower and middle class neighborhoods, and it should change immediately. What's more, aesthetically, it only detracts from our economic growth and vitality by having those overhead things. Not only in terms of reliability for electricity, but just aesthetically, it's damaging the city. And whatever we can get to do with FPL in terms of a partnership is a very good idea. I would also bring in the future of the country, the future of the world, and that is solar energy on top of new buildings and how we can transport that back to FPL and utilize that when we do have outages. And there are a lot of things that are, you know, part of that puzzle. And I would hope that somebody in the city government is actively, you know, knowledgeable about electrical engineering and is able to communicate effectively with FPL to make the city the best it can be. I appreciate you and I think it was you and Miner who brought this up, I think. And I hope that we move forward, including, you know, we don't have DC power coming into the city. And the future is Tesla cars, electrified cars that within the next 5 years will have, instead of gas stations, will have DC-powered fuel stations that can power up cars for 400 miles, 500 miles, 600 miles within 15 to 20 minutes. Right now it's about 45. But we don't have any of those power solutions in the city of Miami Beach, and we need those to be effective economically and especially because we're high-density multifamily dwelling units, so we don't have a lot of – well, we do have mid-beach that is single-family dwelling. But most of Miami Beach is high-rise, and we don't have enough capacity within the buildings to handle hundreds of cars. So we desperately need those high-speed power systems that only DC can provide, not AC. So those are my comments, and thank you for bringing this up, because it's very important to the city over the next 10 years. Very important.
Okay. Okay. Conclude this item for the day. I want to welcome my colleague, Commissioner Fernandez. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we'll show the FPNL item as continued to October 25th as well.
Yep.
And that also raises a question, Chair, about the date. You know, I moved my finance meeting because it was scheduled after the 18th, so the next meeting is October 18th. So just ask you not to make a decision now, but you may want to move it before. If there's something that we need to move out of this committee to move to the October 18th commission meeting, if we have the meeting after the 18th, we won't be able to move it.
So what are you thinking? Should we just move this to the full commission now?
We can move it there, or if you want to entertain moving the land use meeting to prior to the 18th.
I understand. Prior to the 18th, yeah.
Yeah, because if we have a meeting after the 18th, anything that we move is not going to make it to.
Well, I don't know if we can do that today. We'll have to do that
right.
Offline.
Right, okay. Exactly.
All right,
exactly.
We'll try to schedule.
Okay.
October 11th? Yeah. I'm available the 11th as well.
Yeah.
Tom, I believe there's a design review board meeting on the 11th here, right?
That's what they'll have to check to see if the chamber is available. But I'm available on the 11th as well. So, but we'll have to see.
There is a DRB meeting. There's an HPB meeting on the 10th, a DRB meeting on the 11th. The 12th would probably be okay. The 9th.
I can do the 12th.
On the 11th? Yeah, the 12th, 13th, I'm out of town, so the 11th. But maybe in the afternoon. What time is that DRB meeting?
The DRB meeting usually will end probably around 3.
Long meeting. What time does it start?
9.
Wow. They're long meetings.
Yeah, they're long agendas.
Okay. Well, let's see if we figure something out.
3:30 on the 11th?
Yeah, I'm fine taking a late meeting.
Okay,
let's pencil it in. Let's try to get it on the calendars for the afternoon on
I'll confirm with Heather that it's available on the 11th, like after 3:30. And then what we'll do is everything that was continued to October 25th will just move to the newly scheduled meeting of October 11th.
Okay.
And then did you want to keep the November 1 meeting? Because that was meant as an overflow of the October 25th meeting.
Let's keep it for now.
Just in case.
Okay.
Yeah, just
yeah.
keep yeah.
Okay.
In case, yeah. Don't know what's going to come up. Okay. Great. All right, Commissioner Fernandez.
Let's see. We've got – let's try to take care – yeah, you're here for item number four. I believe we've taken care of a lot of business. Let me bring up my item, item number nine. Hopefully we can dispense with this quickly and maybe pass it on to the full commission. I believe Commissioner Dominguez, maybe folks have reached out to you on this as well. I'm not sure. This is discussing expanding the geography of the formula of retail restrictions in Sunset Harbor. I live in Sunset Harbor, full disclosure. A number of residents have come up to me to requesting that we expand our formula retail restrictions to include the overlay going to Dade Boulevard and Alton Road. Some concern that some of the properties there, either now or in the future, might convert to formula retail, which is a restriction that we have a prohibition against in the Sunset Harbor neighborhood. Tom, do you want to say anything about this item?
Yeah, I can give you a very brief overview on this. As noted in the Land Use Committee memo, the overlay district, the formula retail district that was created for Sunset Harbor when it was adopted, created two sub-areas. And this was primarily done for legal defensibility. The perimeter commercial corridors are those areas that front essentially Alton Road and Dade Boulevard. And then we established a neighborhood center, which is the remainder of Sunset Harbor. The prohibition on formula restaurants and other types of retail and commercial establishments now are within the neighborhood center. However, these formula establishments are not prohibited along the perimeter. I believe the sponsor would like to discuss extending the formula prohibition to the perimeter area, which would require an amendment to Chapter 7 of the Resiliency Code. And that's something where I believe this committee could make a recommendation to the commission. And if it's a recommendation to this commission, we could place this on the October 18th commission agenda as a C4 referral to the planning board.
Okay. You want to go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spoke to the Sunset Harbor Neighborhood Association on this item, and they're 100% supportive. So I think it's a good idea.
Got a question. And I'm generally supportive of this. I guess we're concerned about the space that perhaps Michael's used to occupy. Okay. What would meet the definition of formula retail, just in general?
We have the definition within the code, and it's based upon, let me pull it up. It's based upon the number of establishments that exist, both at a national level and a state level. Mm-hmm.
And Tom, if you'd like, I can just introduce. There's a legal issue that we look at very closely whenever we adopt formula retail regulations, which is that that the city under the Dormant Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution is has to be careful not to discriminate against interstate commerce. So what does that mean? It means businesses that operate either out of state or at the national level in multiple states. So we've always drafted our formula retail definitions carefully. And so it's not just about the number of locations, but it's also and really primarily about the uniqueness of the particular business, of the design, of the aesthetic, of their array of food options or merchandise. So it's Tom, when you go through the definition, make sure to include the uniqueness of formula retail and formula restaurant establishments, because a national chain could theoretically operate in a district where formula retail is prohibited, but they'd have to do it in a manner that was unique from its other establishments.
But I have a question. Under the proposal, this would apply to retail. Would it apply to, like, for example, a grocery establishment, or let's say a restaurant establishment? Let's say, like, Hillstones. Hillstones is, you know, a national brand. Someone could say they're formula, and I think perhaps they probably even meet the definition of formula. So instead of having to go to Ball Harbor and go to the second floor of Ball Harbor to eat at a place like that, let's say they want to open in a space like the space that Michaels used to occupy, would this amendment to the code with the definition of formula prohibit restaurants from going in there?
Well, I can take your first question first, which was grocery stores were specifically excluded from the definition when we adopted the Sunset Harbor overlay. So the restriction does not apply to grocery stores. The existing ordinance does restrict restaurants in the neighborhood. How do we call it? The neighborhood center of Sunset Harbor. Mm. And then as to whether a specific, you know, restaurant would qualify under the definition, you know, obviously we would, any definition needs to be drafted in a manner that would apply broadly as a matter of policy. I don't know if a specific restaurant will qualify. We have to look at that closely.
Okay.
Yeah. Let me maybe assuage your concerns, because I help draft it with Tom and counsel. We wanted to try something narrowly tailored so that, you know, we wouldn't run into, conflicts with the Interstate Commerce Clause.
Right.
And we did this on Ocean Drive and Central Harbor, to try to preserve unique characteristics of a neighborhood while still allowing for, a vibrant local economy. There are thresholds, and I'm going off memory. I think in the case of restaurants, I think the threshold is 100 and something. So it's not so exclusive as to prohibit a Hillstones, for example, that doesn't have hundreds of stores. I think it has many dozens. But it would prohibit, like, a Hooters, for example, or a McDonald's or Fridays, to my knowledge, have many hundreds, if not thousands, of establishments. And nothing right. against those establishments. I ate at a Olive Garden recently. But it changes the character of a neighborhood like a Sunset Harbor, where we're trying to have more mom and pops and independently owned establishments versus what you could find in a suburban shopping
sure.
mall.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I'm happy to support the item.
Can I ask? So how many stores? So, for example, Michael's that was there. If this were to change, would Michael's be allowed to be there today?
If there are more than 100 Michael's in operating nationally, then no.
The number is 100.
That's the number in the Sunset Harbor overlay.
And is that's also applicable to restaurants as well?
I think the threshold
restaurants
for restaurants
is 200.
200, yeah.
200. So, for example, there was in that, I think it was in that building, Starbucks was there for a bit, right? So then Starbucks they would no longer be allowed to be there.
Yes, correct.
You see, I don't think Starbucks was bad. I just think the location was not right for a Starbucks.
Right. Exactly. It was not. I think you're right. I don't think that, having a Starbucks on Alton was a bad thing. It's just, I think it was a bad location for them. I think that's probably what they figured out, right? Maybe because of parking. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would encourage all of. I live in the neighborhood. I would encourage talk to the neighborhood association and how they feel. Nothing against Starbucks. But to the extent that a neighborhood says, look, we want to have a Black Panther coffee or Panther coffee, which is a locally owned business versus a Dunkin' Donuts, and I'm drinking a Dunkin' Donuts right now, or Starbucks, the neighborhoods, should be able to weigh in on what they want for the character of the neighborhood.
I have a question. Would you be amenable, because my concern is, how long has it been since Michael's left there? It's been a while.
Since COVID.
All right. So it's been about 3 years that has been sitting there empty. And, I always want to lift up our different areas in the city and shed positive light on them. But some of our more serious challenges are in areas like Ocean Drive, where we have legislation like this in place. And I'm wondering, maybe we should have like a conditional use element where perhaps, something that might be extraordinary that we might not be thinking of now comes along and we then say, gosh, I wish we would have had the mechanism by which to allow, you know, this establishment to be here, but we outlawed it 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago. So maybe have some sort of conditional use mechanism or some other mechanism so that there could be some sort of an avenue. If the property is empty and the landlord does find a good tenant who happens to meet the definition of formula of retail, that then, you know, it's not automatically rejected and now the landlord is forced to keep a space empty. You know, maybe a conditional use mechanism still allows that community that notice and come and speak before the planning board and get in place whatever conditions they may feel might be necessary, and even denial if it doesn't fit in with the character of the neighborhood. But we don't now stem the opportunity for a landlord to be able to fill empty real estate, because there's one thing that we have enough of in this city is empty commercial real estate. And just maybe just a thought, because I want to legislate in the present, you know, thinking about the future and potential unintended consequences, making sure that we don't get in the way of these of landlords.
And Commissioner, we'd be happy to research that. My first thought is that a process like that would need to be drafted carefully so that the board isn't picking and choosing which brands it likes or doesn't like. It would need, you know, the decisions have to be made on objective criteria. But I'm happy to look at that.
I mean, I defer to the sponsor, because the sponsor, I know, is looking after the best interests of the neighborhood, especially being that you live right there. So I know you understand the dynamics there. I want to give deference to you on that. I just want to be careful that we don't end up with real estate that stays empty for an excessive amount of time.
Yeah. No, I agree. I remember, you know, when we crafted this legislation, you know, many years ago, we went through painstaking process to try to get the number right, and there was a whole economic analysis done on you know, what are the right thresholds where you're not overly restrictive, but you're not overly right. permissive, so that, you know, then, you know, we don't want, you know, Miami Beach to turn into like Bayside, where, you know, there's a million types of those developments.
We don't want bubble gump.
You don't want those things, because people come to Miami Beach for the uniqueness. I mean, Lincoln Road is a great example of, you know, what it was 20 years ago when people literally used to go there for all the unique stores and restaurants that it had, and then, you know, what it became, where you've got, you know, a Gap and a Nike store on every corner, and I got nothing against those, but you can find those anywhere. And so you end up killing your tourism when the uniqueness of your neighborhood goes away. So there's a balance we're trying to strike here.
Is there a square footage that's associated with this policy
that it would apply to, you know, retail
Not
spaces?
In Sunset Harbor, yes, in Lincoln Road.
Okay.
I don't think we ever did square footage restrictions in Sunset Harbor, if I recall.
And just based on the case law, any square footage restriction would need to apply uniformly to a formula retail establishment as to any other retail establishment.
Okay. And has this been to the planning board yet?
No.
No. Okay. All right. I'm happy to support it. I mean, I get feedback from the planning board.
So right now, the overlay includes everything but Alton and Dade Boulevard. Do I have it right?
I think that's right, Tom. Is that
right? The perimeter area is identified in the overall Sunset Harbor overlay,
okay.
But the same formula prohibitions don't apply to the perimeter. They only apply to the interior.
Yes, so my concern is just the question that was raised, is that Michael's location's been vacant for 3 years, and is this going to make it more difficult for a landlord to try to fill the space? Yeah, I mean, it's a big space, and it's been sitting vacant, so this could make it even more difficult for someone to come along. And I mean, I kind of feel like Alton Road is different from the interior of Sunset Harbor. So that's what I'm worried about. I also think that Dade Boulevard is different from Alton Road.
Mr. Chair,
Do we still have Ronnie Van Barb's project, the hotel? Is that still planned to go at that location where that oddly shaped parcel is at?
That's actually a residential apartment project. He is proposing to do short-term rental with accessory restaurant uses. My understanding is that he intends to move forward with that. He does have his land use board approvals, but I don't believe he has come in for building permit yet.
And if I recall properly, there were certain high-end restaurants and uses associated to
He didn't identify a specific restaurant tenant. He seemed to indicate that they wanted to have an above-average restaurant tenant for the space, but he did not identify who his tenants were.
Which is kind of consistent with the character of what Sunset Harbor is, you know, not just average, going a little bit above average. Okay. Mr. Chair, I mean, I understand the good intentions of this ordinance. I'm willing to support this. Was this a dual referral that you made?
Well, not yet. Depends on what we want to do here. Do we want to send a dual referral? Do we want to send it to the commission and then planning board?
I think we benefit from getting input from the planning board on something like this. I think it gives us a unique perspective from individuals in this field who might chime in with some good suggestions.
So it was not done as a dual referral, right? So it would have to go back to the commission, right, to send it to the planning
Good
board?
Point. Yeah, that's right.
So I'm not prepared to support it until it goes to the planning board. So what I would like to support, Chair, I would support let's send it to the commission with the recommendation that the commission send it to the planning board. Because I'm worried about this you know, I don't think that it was a problem having a Starbucks there. That's just my personal feeling. Oh. And I worry about the restaurant that we don't know what's going to be there. I doubt that it'll be more than 100.
No.
But I'm worried about, like, that Michael's space has been vacant for 3 years. And the truth is that only somebody with deep pockets is going to be able to afford. And that's what's going on with Lincoln Road, right? I mean, the rents went up, and so people had these formula models can support paying the rent, and that's a problem.
I have a question. If this ordinance passes, let's say, like for example, I think of Office Depot.
Mm-hmm.
Office Depot that's there in Sunset Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the best use of that land? I'd say it's not the best use of that land. And kind of the use of the land over time is inconsistent now with the current character of the neighborhood. At one point it was, when it was more industrial and commercial, but now it's evolved over time, and that is not the best use of that land. But I have to say, there is a benefit to having an Office Depot in Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
If this ordinance were to pass, they wouldn't be able to go into that space. And while probably that this might not be the ideal space to have an Office Depot, there really will never be a real true ideal space for an Office Depot in a city like Miami Beach, but we wouldn't be able to have it there in that space if this ordinance passes. I think it's, you know, where Office Depot is situated, it's actually convenient to Miami Beach residents and
committee in July. You wanted to see what the planning board continued to this meeting.
And the most important thing for me here is we have a planning board that is supposed to act as our local, the individuals who we entrust with the expertise to review these applications. In the past, when we've seen applications for increases in FAR, they usually start with a city commissioner. Usually, we get approached by a property owner or their representative, and one of our colleagues sponsors it, and then it goes to the planning board. And what happens is that it becomes very politicized. It becomes at times very, very tense. The planning board might feel influenced because of either who's sponsoring or because of who's detracting support from it, and who's criticizing it and who's not criticizing it. And then what is supposed to be an objective review becomes a highly politicized process. This kind of insulates this for a more objective and thorough review based on the criteria that we've set here of, well, what is the amount of square footage that's being built? And not just because that's easy math, but how much of that translates to residential square footage together mixed with office and hotel and other uses? And a true analysis of the infrastructure impacts that right now we don't get to do. And allowing that to happen in an objective manner, the impacts on traffic and mobility and water and parking and sewer infrastructure, allowing for that more thorough analysis and the visualization and the illustration of massing, which should be properly vetted outside of any political rhetoric. And that's, to me, important here. While still allowing us as a legislative body the ability to look at broad policy as it relates, whether it be workforce housing or other matters that we want to incentivize through the use of FAR, while allowing us to be able to initiate those more broad policy type of FAR increases with a 5/7 vote. Referral. That's my item, Mr. Chair. I welcome the input of you and our colleagues.
Colleagues? Yeah, I just want to, you know, thank you, commend you for working on this, because I agree with, you know, one of the statements you made is that for us and, you know, future commissions, we need a process, right, so that these things don't look arbitrary, so that we can be consistent, and even, you know, for applicants, they know what that process will look like, so that, you know, we can you know, be consistent and formal and deliberate in our approaches to these kinds of requests. So for me, I think, you know, so long as we have the public hearing elements, the formal planning board review process, and then the linchpin for me is keeping this at a 5/7 vote. You weren't here and articulated why I firmly believe that that's the right number, as opposed to a 6/7 or 7/7, which I think is horrific policy. Then I'm okay with this, and we can always tweak it if we miss something, but I'm supportive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I apologize. I had to step out for a minute. This went to the planning board, right?
This did go to the planning board, and I believe that the planning director mentioned that it got a favorable recommendation.
That's correct. Yeah. Okay. They did make a recommendation, Commissioner Richardson, that an exceptions provision be included, a defined exceptions provision, not something where the commission could just waive it, but the exceptions provision that we had drafted is very specific to certain types of FAR increases. And so that has been included in the memo, and if the commission collectively is supportive of that, we could include it in the ordinance for second reading if it's included as part of a first reading approval.
And Commissioner Fernandez, it's your item. Have you looked at this exception thing that was added based on the recommendation, and you support it?
Yes, I believe it was also unanimously. It was not just supported by the planning board, but it was a unanimous vote of the planning board in its support. And I think it's reasonable.
That doesn't always happen there, by the way.
It does not. It does not.
And does this also retain the 5/7? Because I agree with the chair that I think it needs to stay at 5/7.
Yes, and I got to tell you, I was pondering about this because the one thing that I do not want, while I instinctively feel that, you know, the moment we're eliminating the voter referendum, well, there's other items in the charter that when you don't have a voter referendum, you have a 6/7 vote of the city commission. I'm not going there here just because I fear preemption from the state.
I think that's exactly
the retaliation of Tallahassee would be so fierce towards our city that they've got such a huge target on us that I just felt that it was just best to keep it. It's still a very thorough, very, very thorough vetting process.
Yes, yeah, so I'm supportive of this.
Thank you.
Me too.
Thank you, commissioners.
Yeah, thanks for taking the lead.
Thank you.
All right, so I'll just by acclamation show that the Land Use Committee supports the proposal, and we'll transmit that recommendation to the City Commission.
Thank you, Tom.
Any callers, Nick, on this?
No callers.
And by the way, Mr. Chair, I just want to give also deference, appreciation to Tom and our planning staff because, you know, they guided. My name's on the memo, but they were the ones that guided me in what would be the proper steps here in making sure there was something that really protects the public but also ensures a smooth process. So thank you, Tom, and your staff for putting together what I think will be a great process that we can always tweak if needed, but I think it's a good start.
Yeah.
Before I forget, Mr. Chair, I confirm with Heather that this room is available at 3:30 on October 11th. So we'll go ahead and show the October 25th Land Use Committee meeting move to October 11th at 3:30. And we'll go ahead and update the calendars.
Awesome. Thanks. You get those invites out. Thanks. Okay, good. So dovetail on your item, Commissioner Fernandez, 4, I want to roll over to tonight on my sponsored item number 1. You know, and I was debating whether to, you know, what to do with it, you know, and I'm going to tee it up, then I'm going to turn over to Tom. I started working on this a while ago, and really, again, to your point, Commissioner Fernandez, 99% of the work was done by Tom and his staff, particularly, I think, Rogelio. You know, an enormous amount of work went into this. This was before the Tallahassee legislative session this past year. You know, we were contemplating, you know, do we want to have, you know, some formal policies as guides to try to create incentives for additional floor area ratio, FAR, to incentivize workforce housing. You know, the idea would be, you know, if we were to let the development community know, like, if you come to us with ideas for new FAR increases for particularly workforce housing, that's something that we could get behind and take to the voters. Now, the voter approval process has been eliminated. It's kind of back in our court where, you know, what do we want to have as a policy guide, you know, not necessarily set in stone, but at least as a guide to help us think through applications or, you know, communications out to the development community to say, look, if you're going to do projects that are going to come to us for additional FAR requests, you know, we can provide some guidelines as to what we might entertain, particularly as it pertains to workforce housing. Tom and his team, I think, have put together a really, in my opinion, excellent guide as to, you know, places in our community where we want to see more workforce housing potentially go up, and what those bonuses might be. So I think if we're going to, you know, move forward with item number four, we might want to have, as a policy guide, something along the lines of item number one, which, you know, outlines where and when we would want to have additional FAR available for workforce housing. Tom, is that
sure.
pretty decent?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have to give most of the credit to Rahelio from my staff, who did a very good job of coming up with the overall framework. And as the committee may recall, we last discussed this at our June meeting. And at the time, the committee asked us to go back and take a look at a more defined ordinance based upon certain criteria, including the percentage increase of FAR based upon specific defined criteria, which would be subject to the DRB and HPB as applicable, for properties within local historic districts, creating minimum retention requirements for contributing buildings, that the areas, the defined areas of the city correspond to areas identified for transit-oriented development, and that parking reductions be narrowly tailored and based on proximity to regional transit routes. The draft ordinance is included, and it's summarized in the memo. And basically what it does is it creates areas for FAR bonuses for workforce or affordable housing within TOD areas. And these would include the Fifth Street corridor, the Alton Road corridor from approximately Fifth Street to Collins Canal, the 17th Street corridor from approximately West Avenue to Washington Avenue, and then in North Beach, properties with frontage along 71st Street and Normandy Drive within the CD2 and TC and TCC zoning districts. These incentives would not be included in areas zoned single family or light industrial. Within the eligible parcels, the DRB or the HPB, based upon the express criteria in the ordinance, would have the authority to approve up to a 25% FAR increase within the specific area, and then within 500 feet of the TOD area, which is basically on the map, the areas in yellow, they could approve up to a 15% bonus. The ordinance also allows the DRB or HPB to approve up to 14 additional feet in building height to accommodate the new FAR. And then the minimum criteria has been established. We believe that this criteria can be further developed and refined as we move forward with this process. The minimum standards for the FAR bonus eligibility have been updated to include a requirement that any contributing buildings within a local historic district be substantially retained, preserved, and restored as determined by the Historic Preservation Board. With regard to off-street parking, as noted in the memo, we essentially came up with two options. One option would be to amend Chapter 5 to remove the minimum parking requirements for workforce housing within the TOD areas. And again, this is not prohibiting parking. This just removes the requirement. To the extent a developer wanted to provide parking, they could. Option two would be to amend Chapter 2 of the LDRs to allow for the minimum parking requirements for workforce and affordable housing developments to be reduced through the commission warrant process. This wouldn't be, like option one, a complete removal, but it would be looked at on a case-by-case basis so the commission could determine whether or not a parking reduction and how much of a reduction is warranted based upon the proximity of a project to transit lines, to public parking facilities, and who the end user of the project would be. A third option would be to simply retain the existing minimum off-street parking requirements, not to touch the parking. The ordinance itself has been drafted and fine-tuned, and we believe it is ready to be referred to the Planning Board for consideration. Since this was not a dual referral, any referral of the ordinance to the Planning Board would require commission approval. So it's really up to the committee to decide at this time whether or not it wants to send it to the commission for a referral to the Planning Board or whether you want to discuss it a little bit more in committee.
Thank you. So I'm full disclosure, I live in the South Beach area, so I'm going to put that on the record. I'm supportive of the concept. I'm not supportive of all of the areas that have been designated. I think that it should not, I don't want to change the character of Flamingo Park and the residential areas of South Beach by providing additional height. So I can't support the map the way it's drawn just because I don't want height increases within the core of that community. I'm okay with increases in the more commercial areas on Alton Road. This also would include Lincoln Road. I don't think we want to see workforce housing and height increases on Lincoln Road. And also it includes the Convention Center campus, the campus where we're sitting today, our City Hall. That may have been an error because I don't think that that was intended. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, that's correct. The map needs to be updated because obviously you're not going to put workforce or affordable housing in a CCC district.
Right. So I can be supportive if it were more to the commercial areas, but I just don't want to change the character, the height increase specifically in the core of Flamingo Park, because I think that would affect the neighborhood. And I say that, and with giving full disclosure, that I live there. And I could potentially be affected as someone who lives in the area.
Yeah, it's fair. Yeah, I mean, my vision, you know, in order to prevent what you're talking about, where you start having, you know, very tall buildings in a building that's traditionally been, you know, low, you know, lower height, is you try to push it out to where you can accommodate it. So, you know, along Fifth Street, particularly right. on the north side, you know, transit oriented development, as Tom mentioned, it is appropriate, right? Because it starts making sense. You have more density where mass transit is or will be, and you can accommodate it better, and aesthetically it looks better. My recommendation would be let's keep pushing this forward so that we can continue to talk about it and put our finger on the scale of where we want additional FAR to go. I'm very worried about this next session in Tallahassee, where you know they're not only going to attack FAR, they're going to attack historic districts as well. So everything we're talking about might be moot. I think we put ourselves in a little bit better posture where we are showing that we're deliberately going through the process of imagining, you know, where some of this development can go. Because look, the housing shortage and housing affordability is at a critical point, not just in Miami Beach, but in Dade County and even the state. And it's not going to get any better. Land use regulations have a lot to do with affordable housing and lack thereof. So unless we start taking more proactive measures, the state legislature is going to preempt us, and we will lose control of land development in our city as we know it. So I think it behooves us to try to do something. I think that will serve us when we go to the legislatures and say, look at all the stuff we've been working on. And so, you know, try to convince them to go easy on preemption.
Yeah. If I can, I totally agree with you that I think it could help us in our messaging in Tallahassee. And I agree, for example, on the Fifth Street corridor, even all the way to Sixth Street. And that was part of that overlay that we were, you know, we never got really that passed, but working with the community there. But so, for example, I just wouldn't move it from 6th to 7th Street because, again, that is moving into the very residential area where buildings are height-restricted. Of course, everything that's already there has a grandfather clause, right? And there are some taller buildings in the neighborhood. I just wouldn't want to see more in that very dense residential area. So... So I don't know where it, you know, what you'd like to do with it. If you want to
We could peel it back if that's what's going to get you comfortable. These are recommendations. They're meant to be a guide, and we're supposed to sit here and deliberate and work with the community to try to come up with something. Like, if we do nothing, I think bad things happen. The city doesn't move forward one way or the other, and then you do have situations like an existential crisis, like Tallahassee, just preempting everything. We just need to work on this. Like, this stuff is hard. That's why we got elected.
Right.
I would say let's move forward and tweak it and give it our best shot.
So if I can. So, for example, I think most of it I could be supportive of. I don't think, for example, it should be in south of 5th. And I think the orange area or the yellow area, for example, is on the school board property. It shouldn't be there, right? I mean, that's not going to. And then the other part of south of 5th, with the exception of that first block, from 5th over to 4th, I agree with that. But I don't think we want to move further south into south of 5th. I'm okay with the commercial areas on Collins. I'm okay Alton. I'm okay in general on West Avenue. There's more density there. But I don't want Lincoln Road. I don't think that would ever happen. But so I just don't want. Unless you do. Do you think that's a possibility?
I agree with you with respect to, like, 7th Street. Don't go that far north. As far as south of 5th, between 4 and 5th would probably be that would probably work. On Lincoln Road, I think I'd be a little more permissive just because I think it can accommodate some height there. And it is a major commercial area, and we have, and hopefully we'll have even more mass transit options. So it's where people can live or would like to live, because there's a lot of jobs between all the hotels and all the retail. So it's a place where workforce housing, I think, would work.
I think this is a very good idea, Mr. Chair, and I also agree that we can't sit back and not do anything. In listening to Commissioner Richardson, it doesn't work for every neighborhood, and so tweaking the neighborhoods and working with the city on the areas that would work is best. And then after that, have community outreach to the neighborhood so that later on there isn't a surprise of people coming at City Hall saying they didn't know about it. So, I'm supportive.
Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So the areas that are along the areas designated for transit-oriented development, I think that those are the areas fronting Alton Road. They're fronting areas like 17th Street and 5th Street that I think make sense for this. The areas that are farther away from the transit-oriented development, I have concern about, because we start to penetrate into the more residential areas, the areas of our city that have a more residential character, and we start to change the character of where people are living now. Potentially, even unintendedly, price out people that are living now, displaced people, I'm sorry, that are living there now. These areas that are fronting transit-oriented development areas, they tend to be more commercial. And in essence, what we're doing, what your policy is doing, is areas where people currently don't live, allowing people to live there. And I'm fine with that. I just would be careful and hesitant about extending this to the areas farther away, that 500-foot area from the transit-oriented development, because then we start going into areas where people currently live. And a lot of times it's been either naturally occurring affordable housing, or is where some of our more attainable housing exists, and we start to displace unintendedly through policy people who have been living in our city for a long time. So these main corridors, 5th Street, Alton Road, 17th Street, I think 17th Street is perfect for consideration of something like this. And even maybe baking in there some sort of a greater incentive when they're not directly abutting a historic district. You know, and I think even 17th Street has potential for that. I just out of curiosity, 41st Street, there's so many of our employment opportunities are along 41st Street. And we have bus rapid transit that's supposed to be coming over the Julia Tuttle. Why doesn't this plan take into consideration 41st Street, the 41st Street corridor, where we're trying to revitalize? And has the mayor's panel looked into it?
I don't believe the 41st Street panel has looked into it. We did include 41st Street in some of our initial broader discussions with regard to other areas. I think with this particular proposal, we wanted to be much more specific to areas that we believe are more ripe for transit-oriented type development. 41st Street, while bus rapid transit is proposed, we also know that they are experiencing a number of challenges with regard to traffic congestion now. And so that's one of the reasons we didn't propose that, at least initially.
Well, but the entire city, I mean, let's realistically, when 41st Street is dealing with the challenges of traffic congestion, I mean, we're also facing it on 5th and Alton. We're also facing it in the 63rd Street area, on the 71st Street area, where we're also looking at this. It's, you know, when 41st Street is experiencing it, it's really... goes beyond it. We just hear about it more because so many people that live in dense areas can only access where they live during rush hour traffic through 41st Street. I don't know. I think it's something that I think we, as we look at the master plan for Mid Beach and for 41st Street, I think it makes sense to be considered there. I also do think in these areas where we're talking about these increases fronting these corridors, I do think, you know, with the Mid Beach neighborhood, let's have a conversation with the Mid Beach neighborhood about 41st Street. Let's have a conversation with North Beach about 71st Street. And in South Beach, let's have a conversation. Let's have a conversation about what, you know, how people feel about creating opportunities for new housing on Alton Road, 5th Street, and 17th Street. Because the one truth is that our population is declining. And Mr. Chair, you know, your policy here could be a catalyst in addressing that. But our quality of life will be affected if our population of full-time residents continues to decline. We will become more transient, and the impacts that are associated with a transient community will become more evident in our own quality of life. So I see this being important. The one hesitation that I continue to have from when we considered this the first time is anything that eliminates parking by up to 100%. That is concerning to me. I think that has an unintended domino effect on the affordability of housing. I think people were able to live in Miami Beach more of our workforce were able to live here when we had more parking available. And over time, you know, we've seen our parking crisis escalate, as has our affordability crisis in our city. And so I think that there's a nexus between being an affordable community and an attainable community for the workforce. There's a nexus to the availability of parking as well, because a lot of our workforce do rely on their automobiles, notwithstanding being along a TOD and access to public transportation. So those are my thoughts on this.
colleagues, anything?
So I don't know if you wanted to try to move it. I would prefer if we could just keep it here. I'd like to work with staff and identify the areas that I at least would like you to consider, you know, amending.
Yeah, first of all, I agreed with your observations. If that's what I agree with your sentiment, yeah. And then if that's what it will take to sort of move this forward, I want to have a guide for us. This all might be moot, not just with Tallahassee, but you know, there's nothing to prevent an applicant coming forward now and saying, "I got this project. Can you give me additional FAR?" Right. And we would do it. But I just think, you know, particularly for future commissions, to know that we've deliberated this and it's gone through, you know, the planning board and everything, and we, you know, we lean towards approving FAR if it falls in this map. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't do a one-off somewhere else for a really spectacular project, but at least it gives us and, you know, the development community a guide to where, you know, we've deliberated, we've hashed it out, and this is where we would lean towards giving additional FAR because it's strategic. That's where I want to push something forward. I was going to potentially even withdraw it because of the changes that have happened in Tallahassee. But I think it does serve us well to have deliberated, created a vision map of where we would prefer to see additional FAR, because I think it makes the process go more smoothly. To Commissioner Fernandez's item four, they go hand in hand. Like, we have a process, and oh, by the way, we also have a map to give you a guide of where we're going to be more favorably disposed versus not. So that's why I want to move this forward. Commissioner Richardson, if you want to work with staff, I'm leaning in your direction. But to your point, 41st Street, I think, should also be one of those areas where we try to incentivize smart development, potentially with additional FAR, if they can meet, you know, all the other criteria for public benefits and design that would go along with it.
And I agree with you, Chair, and maybe we could also ask staff to work on what their recommendation would be for 41st Street area, so that we would have all three areas. And then I'll work with staff at least, you know, to identify my concerns. So, for example, on this map, Sunset Harbor, I mean, we just got through talking about formula stores, right? And then this along Alton and Dade would be included on this map, which would allow for a height increase. And I have a feeling that they're probably not going to want that. And to your point, Commissioner Dominguez, the, you know, I do think that there should be community outreach, right? We should come up with what we think would be workable and then do all this community outreach and see what people think. But I do think moving this forward will help us with our messaging in Tallahassee. So,
okay.
So that would be great. And then we can bring it back on the 11th, I guess.
Yep.
Right. Well, yep.
So we'll in the meantime, Tom, yeah, I'll work with you. And,
okay.
Yeah. And then you'll also work on 41st Street and bring that back, so we'll have all three. And, Chair, I apologize. I'm going to have to leave because I've got a noon meeting, but I know you've got one more item, item 10, and I'm certainly not opposed to extending those if you wish to do that.
Okay. Do you have to leave now?
I got like 5 minutes.
Okay. Let's see if we can do this in 5 minutes. The last item is item number 10, discuss the expired North Beach Town Center mobility fee incentive. Tom, I'll turn this over to you. The applicant reached out to me, and I said I'd hear it. I'm not leaning one way or the other necessarily, but I wanted to give it a hearing, and then I'll share my thoughts.
Sure. I'll be very brief because I know Commissioner Richardson needs to leave. As the committee may be aware, the City Commission adopted a mobility fee ordinance in 2019, which replaced the concurrency management fee. And when this particular fee went into effect in early 2020, the commission also created a North Beach incentive area to try to expedite and incentivize the revitalization of the area north of 63rd Street. As part of that, the commission established in the mobility fee ordinance a tiered reduction in the mobility fee for areas north of 63rd Street. So up until August 31st of 2022, there was a mobility fee reduction of 63%. Between September 1, 2022, and August 31st of 2023, which was this past year, the mobility fee reduction was 50%. Currently, from September 21, 2023, to August 31st, 2024, the current reduction is 38%. Starting on September 1st of 2024 through August 31st of 2025, the mobility fee reduction drops to 26%. And then after September 1, 2025, there are no more mobility fee reductions in North Beach. Any modifications to that would require an LDR amendment.
Yeah. Tom, to your knowledge, or maybe Eric, you know, like, where are they now with respect to moving forward? Because I'm just wondering, you know, if we want to slide these tiers and give them an extension, how close are they to commencing their project?
There are a number of projects that are already permitted. Some, as you're aware, are under construction. So there have been a number of projects that have paid.
Yeah, let me be more specific, because the applicant in this case is you know, Aria, which is, you know, sort of right in the hub of town center.
Mm-hmm.
The land's been assembled. It's, you know, I saw it not too long ago. It's been cleared, and I'm just, but it's been like that for a while. Like, how close are they to breaking ground?
My understanding is that they were very close to getting their full building permit. We did have discussions with them. My understanding is that the only thing holding up the issuance of their full building permit was the payment of the mobility fee. And they were looking for more of a reduction than the 50% reduction that they were eligible for prior to August 31st.
August 31st passed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's right around the time that they were trying to.
Yeah, they're currently eligible for the 38%.
38. Reduction. And the max they would be is 62.5, right?
So correct.
We're between 38 and 62.5. They explained to me, due to COVID, blah, 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 they just got delayed. And so their original ask was for the 62.5%.
Correct.
They were, up until, you know, 3 weeks ago, eligible for 50.
Mm-hmm.
So the question, I guess, before us is, do we want to either give them a grace period of give them a grace so that they continue to get 50%, or give them a sufficient grace period so that it's back to the 62.5, right? And then in dollars and cents, do you know how much money we're talking?
That I don't have that information. No.
That I had the same question. So is it based on, do we know what the fee is? The percentage fee, isn't it based on the amount of the total project, or
no? The mobility fee is set based upon the impact that the project has on our transportation and mobility infrastructure, and it varies by project. It depends upon the size of the project, the trips that it's anticipated to generate. Each project has a different mobility fee. Within North Beach, once
I apologize for interrupting, but is it a percentage of something? Like, you pay 10% of square footage, or you pay so many dollars per square foot?
It's based upon a formula.
Okay.
And once that mobility fee is established, if you're in North Beach, then you get the reduction. So prior to August 31st of this year, you only paid half of what your normal mobility fee would be. Prior to last year, you got a reduction of 63%.
But is the typical mobility fee $100,000, or is it $100?
It can sometimes exceed $100,000 for these much larger projects.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, I'm not opposed to extending the 60, or sliding it, because there were delays in all the projects up there because of COVID. And quite frankly, the other thing is because of the changes in interest rates, right? That has caused people to have to rethink their development plans. And we see that going on right here with the hotel that's been delayed. So I'm not opposed to it. I'm just wondering if we need – I don't want to leave a big hole in somebody else's budget that's coming in. So I don't know if we're talking about giving up $1 million. I don't have a range, or Eric, you said you look like you might have an answer.
So I was just going back to my notes. I had met with them on July 11th, at which point in time they had said that their total mobility fee was approximately $600,000.
That's what I remember. That's their total.
That was their total mobility fee, and my understanding is the mobility fee is based on the uses in the building and the number of trips generated by those uses, discounted by any prior vested uses on the property.
Okay. So with these $600,000 that we would generate in mobility fees, the idea is that we would provide public facilities like buses and trolleys to, I guess, they're not going to provide parking, I would imagine.
No, this project provides actually a significant amount of parking.
They do provide parking. How much, I mean, did they meet the requirements in the parking formula for the district that they're in?
Yeah.
Okay, and... Okay, if they are meeting, how many units are in this development?
That I don't have off the top of my head. It was a mixed-use project. It included some fairly large retail components, mm-hmm. But I don't recall whether it was primarily office or a mix of office and residential.
Yeah, it's been a while. I worked a lot on this. Let's go back, beginning of my tenure. So it's mixed use.
Yeah.
You know, not unlike what we see in Midtown. It's a Target is going to be the anchor.
I remember.
And they've got
design.
Dedicated parking for the retail clients because yes. The retail clients won't come unless they have dedicated yes. parking. The mixed-use apartments, and I think it's 130, and that's yeah. ballpark, they also need parking. So they are providing parking.
I remember when they yeah. came to the planning board for their right. conditional use permit. It was one of my first votes on the planning board.
Yeah,
I don't have a vote. I don't have a vote in this, but I do remember they are providing. Now that you mentioned the Target, I remember now the application, and I remember they are providing the parking that they were required to provide. I would be supportive of this, but I would like to just meet with them before they yeah. come back to the city commission.
The reason I said I'd listen to it again, I'm not leaning more either, is. I was told, and we can confirm this, Eric or Tom, that the only thing pending from them getting their building permit was the payment of this, and I think they wanted direction. How much do we have to pay?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, we'll hear it and give direction. But if that's the case, I prefer to see them breaking ground sooner rather than later. And if it's, you know, just giving them clarity on whether they're going to get a 50% reduction or 62.5% reduction, I would just like to just decide that and move on with our lives, if that truly is the only thing that's pending to get this project rolling.
So what I would support today is changing all these dates to add one additional year. So, for example, up until August 31st of 22, I would change that to 23. And then between September 1st of 23 to August 31st, 24, I'd be willing to give that latitude, especially with COVID and everything.
Yeah, that was a compromise, more or less, that I had in mind. I'm sure the developer would love to try to get 62.5, but
it's a compromise.
It's a compromise, and if that's what we need to do to move forward, I would support that as well.
I'll move that then. I'll move that proposal.
I'll second it if that's okay with you guys.
So this would be... this would be a proposal to amend section 3.3.4 so that the current date for the 50% reduction would be modified to be from September 1, 2023 to August 31st, 2024, add another year to the next one after that.
And the one after year. That.
Yeah. Okay. So the 62.5 is off the table. That's gone.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay, that's the compromise, right. Is that you're already a year late, so...
So this will be something, if this is by acclamation, what I can do is I can put an ordinance on the October 18th C4 agenda, because this will have to go to the planning board. Planning board will transmit it back to the city commission.
Okay.
Okay. We would also need to identify a new sponsor for that, because you'll be termed out by the time this comes back to the commission.
Let's have them meet with me.
Okay. I can put the referral on. It's just okay. that
yeah.
before it comes back to you, we would need to identify the sponsor. That's all.
Have them meet with them.
Okay.
And quite frankly, the developer may just want to move forward if they're trying to break ground, because by the time it goes to the planning board and then it comes back, then we're probably talking January.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and time is money. I mean, I know they like to save some money on the mobility fee, but in the grand scheme of things, I'm guessing it's not that much money relative to the cost of carrying the land and the interest rates and delaying the project further. So hopefully it gives them the clarity and they can pay and move on. Okay.
That's it.
Colleagues, thank you. Great meeting.
Thank you.
Nice seeing you. I'll see you in a couple
see
hours.
See you in a few hours.